There was a great Indian mystic whose name was Kabir. Probably you will find a book outside. His teachings came very near to the teachings of J. Krishnamurti. The song which I shall sing presently conveys the idea of what a truly spiritual life is. The word used here is samadhi. We have become quite familiar, I think, in this group with the word samadhi. Samadhi means spiritual experience, spiritual realization. And the great mystic says that I have had this spiritual experience, but it was so natural. I didn't work hard for it. That means I did not use the usual disciplines that are commonly associated with spiritual endeavor. He says, I did not close my eyes for meditation. I did not plug my ears so that I avoid all those unnecessary noise and sound. I did not close my eyes, I did not plug my ears, I did not do anything that was usually associated with religious life. But then what did I do? He says, I kept my eyes open. Eyes is only symbol, but I kept my heart and mind open, and with a smile on my face, relaxed. Spiritual discipline is not a life of woe and long phase. No, I was completely relaxing. With a smile on my face, I had that spiritual experience. It's a long song, but I shall sing only a few lines. And this is the most important idea, that it was a natural way of life.
Bye. An afternoon that is free. But this evening at 7:30, we will have the second session, the continuation of what we have been discussing. And so the afternoon is free. Do whatever you like. Nobody is going to ask you, what did you do? But we shall meet instead at 7:30 in the evening for further discussions. As was said by Kabir in the song which you have heard just now, spiritual life is most simple. It's not hard. It is very, very simple. This idea has been expressed in all the great religions of the world. You look at Christianity. Jesus says, look at the lilies in the field. They toil not, nor do they spin. And yet King Solomon in all his glory was never arrayed like any one of them. Look at the lilies in the field. If we can live naturally, that doesn't mean live habitually. Habit is our second nature, nature which we have cultivated due to various factors into which we will not go just now. But if we can live like the lilies in the field, like little children, simple, innocent, not ignorant, but innocence with knowledge that we possess, if we can live in a simple manner, then that is really spirituality. In Buddhism, in Zen Buddhism, there is a story. A pupil went to the master and said to the master, "Sir, I want to become Buddha. Please tell me how to become like a Buddha." The teacher did not immediately give an answer. Instead of that, when the pupil persisted in his question, all that the teacher did was, he picked up a small brick that was lying nearby and started rubbing that brick on the floor. And the pupil said, "Sir, what are you doing? I have asked a very serious question, how to become Buddha. Instead of giving me an answer, you are doing this ridiculous thing of rubbing the brick on the floor." And the master said, "I am rubbing the brick on the floor because I want to make this brick into a mirror. By rubbing, I shall make it into a mirror." Then the pupil said, "But this is nonsense. The brick will wear itself out, but it will not become a mirror. It is a work that is absolutely fruitless. You will not be able to achieve your goal." Then the master said, "Young man, you have yourself given an answer to your question. The answer is, you can become only what you are. You cannot become what you are not. If you are not Buddha, you cannot become Buddha. Because trying to become like Buddha will be like rubbing the brick on the floor. You can become only what you are. That is the statement that you find in Buddhism. Turn to Islam. That branch of Islam which is known as Sufism. There was a great teacher, great Sufi teacher, Rabia. And once the pupil went to Rabia and said, Rabia, I have been knocking at the door of reality for quite some time, but the door does not open. Rabia said, yes, it will not open. You may go on knocking at the door for 1,000 years, but the door will not open. Then the pupil said, why? Rabia, tell me, why will not the door open? Is there anything wrong in the way in which I am knocking at the door? Rabia said, no. Rabia said, you may go on knocking for 1,000 years, and the door will not open, for the simple reason that the door has never been closed. The door has never been closed. You are trying to knock at the door which is an open door. Walk through the open door. You are wasting your time by knocking at the door which is never, never closed. These are the simplicities of spiritual life about which all religions have spoken. The door is open, and yet we do not see that the door is open. In fact, in spiritual life, the problem of problems is to see what is. To see what is. If only we could see what is, then we can walk. We don't require any outside help whatsoever. Such is the simplicity of spiritual life. We have been discussing this, and in the course of our discussion, we found yesterday that the spiritual life about which Hindu psychology speaks, and Hindu psychology is fundamentally spiritually oriented. In the Hindu psychology, we are told, discover yourself. Discover yourself. Why? Have we lost ourselves? What is the meaning of discover yourself? Have we lost? And yet we are interested in yoga. And you know what yoga means? Yoga really means union. The word yoga comes from yuja in the Sanskrit language. It means union. But union with what? Ordinarily, the answer is union with the Absolute, union with God. But then in Hindu philosophy, the ultimate reality and the human individual are not two at all. The ultimate reality is not away from the human individual. And therefore, union with God really means union with ourselves. That is the meaning of yoga. To be united with oneself. But have we been separated from ourselves? Yes, we have been separated by ourselves. And that is why we do not know ourselves. Know thyself is the dictum that has been given both in the East and in the West as a part of spiritual discipline. Know thyself. We do not know ourselves. That is what we were talking about yesterday, that what we call the I, the self, the ego, whatever name you want to give, this we really do not know. We have only made an image of ourselves. As I said yesterday, we recognize ourselves, but we do not know ourselves. Recognition is possible by the outer patterns of behavior, by the habits, the way in which habits are expressed, we can recognize ourselves. And the real mystery of spiritual life is that while we recognize ourselves, we do not know ourselves. What we call the I, the self, the ego, what we call as ourselves is only an image which the mind has built. We have projected that image outside. We look at that image and we have identified ourselves with this image. That is what in the yoga aphorisms Patanjali speaks about, that there is a false identification. We have identified ourselves with the image which the mind has constructed, and we have regarded ourselves as the image. And therefore, I must guard this image, protect this image, do everything that is possible in order that the image may not be carried away, image may not be destroyed. And therefore, all our effort has been to guard this image. And this has become the bane of modern life. It is this which has produced tensions, stresses and strains. To guard myself. And I don't know what I am. I am guarding something that is fictitious, something that is false, something that is unreal. And yet out of this endeavor to guard something that is unreal, we have created the tremendous problems of tensions, stresses and strains, which are the cause of many of our physical and mental illnesses. In other words, we are only looking at our image, identifying ourselves with that image. How is this image brought into existence? This image is something which the mind has put together. The mind has put together. Mind is indeed the great slayer of the real. And one of the processes of slaying by the mind is that it has slayed ourselves. We do not know ourselves because there is an image, there is a veil that has been put. In one of the Upanishads it is said that the face of truth has been covered over with what? With a golden veil. The golden veil has been woven by the mind. The mind by its cleverness, mind by its dexterity, has woven a beautiful veil, golden veil, and that veil has been cast so that I do not see the face of truth, I see only the veil. And if somebody says, why don't you remove the veil? Some wise man comes and says, remove the veil, and you will see here and now at this very moment this veil. But I am not willing to remove the veil. Because I am in love with the veil. Oh, the veil is so beautiful. There can't be anything more beautiful than the veil. And therefore, I want that veil to remain. And yet I want to see myself. It's an impossible thing. Remove the veil and here and now, at this very moment, in fact, you do not require the time process. In this very moment, you will be able to come to the discovery of what you are. In one of the Hindu scriptural texts, I have referred to it earlier, the Hindu scriptural text that is named as Ashtavakra Gita. Ashtavakra is the teacher, and the teacher is instructing the pupil, who is King Janaka, a very well-known king in Hinduism, King Janaka. And this sage, this teacher, is instructing. The pupil says to the teacher, sir, I want to be liberated. I am not interested in anything else. I want to be liberated. Please show me the way of liberation. And there is a beautiful verse in that Ashtavakra Gita, which just in one verse explains the whole problem. The teacher says to the pupil, I am not quoting in Sanskrit because it will not mean anything. It's a beautiful verse in the Sanskrit language, which says, in Sanskrit he says, Yadi deham pratakrutva chiti vishramya tishtasi adhu naiva sukhi shanto bandhamukto bhavishyasi. It says, if you can separate yourself from the image, that these are the exact words, if you can separate yourself from the image, if you can break the identification with the image that has taken place, if you can separate yourself from the image, then what have you to done? What have you to do? You don't have to do anything. Be completely relaxed. Be in a state of total relaxation. You don't have to do anything. And it says, here and now, at this very moment, you will be happy, you will be at peace, and you will come to self-realization. You will come to self-realization. At this very moment come, all that we have to do is to separate yourself from that image. Our difficulty in spiritual life, in deep psychological life, our difficulty is that we are hugging to the image. We are embracing the image. We regard ourselves as the image. The false identification has taken place. All that has to be done is to break this false identification. But how is this to be done? How can we separate ourselves from the image? How can the image be put aside? Because that is all that has to be done. If the image is put aside, and the image is created by the mind, we shall go into the question as we proceed further. How does the mind create this image? But one thing is certain, that the image is created out of our experience, good or bad, out of the residue of that experience, out of the incomplete experiences of the past. I have created this image and I have identified myself with that image. That is what the Hindu psychology speaks about, the identification with the image. Break that identification, and here and now you are free. Here and now you will be at peace. You will be completely happy. But the question of questions is, how to break, how to be separated from the image that we have created? Because it is the separation in terms of the image which has produced this great psychological problem. In fact, the question in spiritual life, in psychological life, in terms of the Hindu psychology, is to know ourselves. In other words, to break this identification, the false identification that has taken place, the identification that has taken place because there is not the right perception. In spiritual life, right perception is the problem, nothing else. If I can have right perception, then here and now I know what I am. Who am I? In Hindu religious denominations, teacher after teacher has spoken about this. Know thyself, know thyself, know thyself. Find out who you are. If I can find out who am I, then I have nothing else to do. Because then the being that I am, the being itself will express itself in becoming. The whole of the world is in the process of becoming. We are all concerned with becoming. I want to become something, become something, become something. But this whole process of becoming has reduced itself to rubbing the brick on the floor. We are going on rubbing and rubbing and rubbing, and nothing comes. The mirror is not produced. We are frustrated. All our becoming is a process of frustration. It is bound to be a process of frustration. Because the starting point of the process of becoming is not being. Our starting process of becoming is our mental image. From the image we want to become something. And that is why the whole process of becoming is frustrating. In nature, all the time becoming goes on. The seed becomes a tree. The child becomes a man. This process of becoming all the time goes on. But in nature, the process of becoming does not create any problems of frustration. The mango tree never wants to produce an apple. The mango tree is satisfied to produce mangoes, better mangoes, sweeter mangoes. It never aspires to produce apples. But you and I, in our process of becoming, we do not want to be ourselves. We want to be like somebody else. And therefore the whole process is the process of imitation. If I can be just myself, but I am not able to become that, become myself, because I do not know what I am. And that is why to know oneself is the problem of problems so far as psycho-spiritual process is concerned. We were discussing yesterday the states of consciousness as described by Shankaracharya, as described in Hindu books, that there is, first of all, the awareness with choice, the mind becoming aware. And the awareness of the mind is always awareness with choice. I shall take this, I shall reject this particular thing. This process of rejection and identification goes on. That is the awareness with choice. That is what is known in the Hindu books as the state which is Jagrat. In other words, it is a state which can be described as awareness with choice. Then comes the second state about which we discussed yesterday. There comes the awareness without choice, which is known in Hindu psychology as the dream state. We are in a dream state. In dream state, you have to accept what comes. You cannot do any selection, any rejection, or any acceptance. Acceptance and rejection has no place so far as the dream state is concerned. This is the second state about which the Hindu psychology speaks. Then comes the third state, which is the deep sleep state. In deep sleep there is awareness, but awareness of a different category. It is awareness in which I am not even aware. The person is not aware. The person is not aware that there is an awareness. That is the condition of deep sleep. I will not go over all this again because we have discussed it yesterday. And then comes the fourth state, which is known as pure awareness. Remember, this may seem to us a little strange, but this is exactly what is being discussed partly in Western psychology. We know, as we understand psychology today, that there is a conscious mind. We all of us are aware of the conscious mind. We live consciously. The conscious mind is the first state, and man must come to the awakening of the conscious state so that he is able to select what needs to be selected. Otherwise he might lose his way. And therefore the conscious mind is the mind comparable to the Jagrat, so far as the Hindu psychology is concerned. It is awareness with choice. I am in a position to choose. I am in a position to take a particular path, reject another path. It is possible for me because it is my conscious mind that is functioning. This we are familiar with. I do not think it is necessary to labor this point, but still one might say that our so-called conscious mind also is not fully conscious. There are many, many things which we do not see, which we should be able to see. because our senses function in an imperfect manner, because our minds also function in an imperfect manner. And therefore we might say that we are conscious, but we are almost a semi-conscious. We are not fully conscious at all. Nevertheless, the conscious mind is something with which the Western psychology is familiar. Then there is the subconscious mind, made known to us by the investigations of Freud. Freud particularly focused our attention to this subconscious mind. There are so many things which are put in the subconscious mind. In fact, there is a beautiful example which Freud himself has given. Freud says that there is a family which stays on the ground floor. There is another family which is staying in the basement. And the basement family is not a very respectable family. There are many children. It is a family which is a poor family, not a family which can live in great style. But it is a family which is engaged in receiving guests. And just when the ground floor family people are receiving important guests, the children from the basement come up. The basement family is a poor family. There is no population control. There are many children, and the children come up constantly from the basement to the ground floor. And the children come up with tattered clothes, dirty clothes, uncouth, not properly looked after. These children come up. And the children come up just at that moment when the ground floor family is engaged in talks, in welcoming a very, very important person. Just at that moment, these uncouth children come up. And therefore the ground floor family feels little nervous that just at this moment the children will come. And therefore they push back the children. Children, as they come, the children are pushed back. But the children are irrepressible. They come up again and again, again and again. At last the ground floor family is tired and it decides to employ a watchman. And the duty of the watchman is to see that these children do not come up. That is the only task that the watchman has to do. And therefore the watchman, the moment the children come, the children are pushed back. But the children are very clever. The children borrow some clothes so that they appear in good clothes. And therefore the watchman thinks, oh, these are other children. These are not the children of the basement family. And therefore these children are welcome. But they are the same children. They come with borrowed clothes. Or the children see, oh, the watchman is asleep. And taking the advantage of the watchman being asleep, the children come up. This is the story that Freud gives. This is the story of the relationship of the conscious and the subconscious mind. In the subconscious mind, things come up which we want to be suppressed. We have suppressed many, many things. And therefore, during our waking moments, these things cannot come up. The impulses of the subconscious cannot come. And therefore they come in dream. That is why it is a dream state. They come in dream. It is in dream that the subconscious appears. Appears probably in borrowed clothes. Appears in clothes which are not the usual clothes. They appear in symbols. They appear in a curious manner. We do not seem to understand the meaning of the dreams. But there is a meaning of the dreams in as much as in that dream it is those basement children, uncouth, dirty children who are coming up all the time. This is what is known as the dream state, about which the Western psychology also speaks. The condition that happens in the subconscious mind, in the activities of the subconscious, we have pushed back into the subconscious many, many things. This is comparable to the Hindu psychology, where the Hindu psychology speaks of the dream consciousness. In the dream consciousness, there is no choice whatsoever. You have to accept the children as they come. or push back the children. But the more you push back, the more resisting are these children. They go on coming again and again, and therefore this is the dream state about which the Hindu psychology speaks, about which the Western psychology also speaks. But there is a further development in Western psychology. It has not ended merely with the subconscious. It speaks of the unconscious. And Jung's psychology is particularly indicative of this unconscious. There is the unconscious, the racial unconscious, the unconscious of the whole humanity, which resides in that unconscious. It is this unconscious which is comparable to the third state about which the Hindu psychology speaks, and that is the deep sleep. Deep sleep, that deep sleep condition in which the racial unconscious expresses itself. The racial unconscious comes, and therefore, so far, the division of the Hindu psychology and the division of the Western psychology is at par. It is not in conflict with each other. But there is the fourth state of consciousness about which the Western psychology is well-nigh silent. It doesn't speak about it. And that is the superconscious. The conscious, the subconscious, the unconscious, and the superconscious. The aspect of consciousness as superconscious is discussed in Hindu psychology, so that man is not just subject to the racial unconscious, not just a slave of the subconscious, but from time to time there come intimations from the superconscious, and superconscious transcends the experience of humanity. It is something which is beyond what humanity has expressed. This something, the intimation of the superconscious comes, and the intimations of the superconscious are discussed in the Hindu psychology, particularly in Hindu psychology, as we shall see this afternoon when we meet and consider the consciousness, the subject of consciousness, as discussed by the Bhagavad Gita. We shall see how the Bhagavad Gita speaks of that intimation of the superconscious, which is a contribution, a special contribution, so far as Hindu psychology is concerned. These are the four states of consciousness in the Western classification, in the Eastern classification, and there is much that is common in this classification, except that the element of the superconscious is something which you do not find very much discussed so far as the Western psychology is concerned. This presence of the superconscious is discussed everywhere in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. You find it discussed in many, many of the books of Hindu psychology and of Hindu mysticism, with which, if you have read them, you should be quite familiar. This idea of the superconscious, that it is possible for you and for me to receive the intimations of the superconscious. How, we will not go into it just now, but it is possible, there is a possibility that I am not just a slave of the past. There is the future, the intimation of the future is possible, and the intimation of the future can be realized when we are dealing with the psychological problems. This is what forms part, so far as Eastern or Hindu psychology is concerned. But then why is it that we are not able to have the experience of the intimations of the superconscious? How can we have? It is here that we must go into the question, a special contribution of Hindu psychology. And that special contribution of Hindu psychology is that there are three attributes by which our present consciousness is governed. There are three attributes. It is somewhat comparable, but only in the elementary sense, with what you find in the writings of the German philosopher Hegel. German philosopher Hegel talked of thesis, antithesis and synthesis. There is the thesis, and there is the opposite of the thesis, which is called the antithesis. And the thesis and the antithesis sometimes come to a synthesis. But the synthesis becomes another thesis, conflicting with antithesis, coming to synthesis. Hegel described this as the world phenomenon. These world phenomenon moves about under these three conditions, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. I said this is, in an elementary sense, comparable to the three attributes about which Hindu psychology speaks. It is these three attributes that stand in our way. If we could be free from these three attributes, then we shall be able to find that our consciousness is quite clear. We are able to come to the pure awareness, the state of pure awareness about which we were speaking yesterday. Pure awareness is that state where there is no interruption at all, where there is no projection at all. If I could see something without any projection, and if we become little aware, if we can study ourselves, we will find that the moment, for example, I see somebody, the moment I see a tree, my immediate inclination is to name it. The naming process is very deeply ingrained in our consciousness. We go on naming things. We go on giving the names of the concepts which we have formed of the outer world. It is this naming process which prevents us from coming to the experience of pure awareness. Everything is color. Everything is motivated. Everything is interfered with by this naming process. And the naming process is done by the mind. The mind feels safe when the mind has been able to give a name to a certain thing. The mind feels safe. Now I am safe because I can call out that name. And when I call out that name, the experience associated with that name will naturally come. And therefore the mind is all the time engaged in naming. We live in a world in which we must give names. If we do not give name, then we feel very, very uncomfortable. Try it. Can you face an experience without naming it? It will create a tension because the mind immediately wants to give a name. Because the mind feels safe by giving a name. Can we see anything? Can we experience anything without giving a name? Have we known what is called the nameless experience? We have not known what is nameless experience because we go on giving name. We have given names to God also. You might have 1,000 names of God, as sometimes the 1,000 names are repeated by the devout Hindu, 1,000 names. But as J. Krishnamurti said once, that in spite of the 1,000 names, it remains nameless. We may give 1,000 names to God, and yet no name is able to convey the real meaning. In the midst of 1,000 names, or in the midst of millions of names, it remains completely nameless. We have not known what nameless is, because the mind immediately covers up everything by names, hundreds of names. And when the names are given, then we feel safe, we feel secure, we know what it is. And therefore, we are no longer in a state of uncertainty. There is nothing unknown that is facing us. We have covered up the unknown with 1,000 names. And because we have covered up the unknown with 1,000 names, we feel completely safe. It is the tendency of the mind. The mind does not want to keep anything unknown. The mind says, please tell us what is. Please tell us what the intangible is. Because if the intangible is put in words, in names, then I feel all right. I know what it is. We want to understand the unknown beforehand. We are unable to keep the unknown as unknown because the unknown as unknown gives us a sense of insecurity. I don't know what that unknown will be. And therefore, I want to cover up I want to screen it. I want to put a veil over the unknown. And it is only when a veil is put on the unknown, then I feel completely safe. This is what we do all the time. The process of naming, because the naming gives us a sense of security. Remember, it is a false security. It is not a real security. But we move from false security to false security by engaging ourselves in giving these names. And therefore, we must understand that these names are given out of the three attributes. Because fundamentally, our consciousness is covered over with these three attributes. The three attributes known in Hindu psychology are tamas, rajas and sattva. Tamas means indolence, inactivity. That is one attribute of consciousness. Where the consciousness becomes indolent, not awake, almost asleep, that is what is called tamas. Tamas, really, the real meaning of tamas is darkness. That our consciousness has the attribute of darkness. Darkness means, if you want to perceive anything, then the first requirement for perception is that you must have light. It is light that enables us to see. Now, there is this attribute of the consciousness, where it is dark, absolutely dark. And that is the first attribute, the attribute of tamas. And we very often find that while we may be very active in one part of our life, we may be completely dormant, completely lazy, completely inactive in some other parts. If I am interested in politics, somebody is discussing politics, I am suddenly awake. But if there is the discussion about philosophy, psychology, then I am asleep. We are not fully awake. We are awake at certain places, at certain other places we are asleep. In fact, most of the time we are asleep, we are not awake at all. I become awake only when the mind is interested in something. And therefore, this is the attribute of tamas, of laziness, of indolence, of inactivity. That is the one attribute with which our consciousness is covered. The second attribute about which the Hindu psychology speaks is the attribute which can be called activity, which is called rajas. Rajas means activity. It is not all the time indolent, lazy, asleep. There are certain aspects of consciousness which are awake. And when those things are spoken about, then suddenly our consciousness becomes awake. We begin to realize what it is. We are quite awake, although we are not awake in certain parts of our consciousness. We are awake in certain other parts of consciousness. And this is what is known as rajas. Then there comes the third attribute, because we all of us are familiar with these attributes. How we are awake at certain places, how we are not awake, how certain things interest us, how certain other things don't interest us. And therefore our development is a lopsided development. Not a statement, not an awakening which is all there, but awakening at certain places, in certain places which are completely dark, and therefore we are asleep. And the attributes of consciousness about which Hindu psychology speaks is a third attribute, which is called sattva. Sattva means a harmony. A certain amount of harmony is brought about. We don't go on in life all the time with conflict. We find out some harmony. We concord some harmony. We produce some harmony. And when there is some harmony, then I am at peace. That harmony gets broken, disturbed. But this is the harmony that we experience. This is roughly the state of our consciousness. Asleep at some places, awake at some other places, in conflict, but sometimes we find some point of harmony whereby the conflict is resolved. But the resolution of the conflict does not remain for long. The resolution of conflict is broken down, and again we are in the same position of tamas, going to rajas, going to sattva. Thesis, antithesis and synthesis seems to be the cycle of life. We go on. For the time being, there is a certain amount of reconciliation is brought about. But the reconciliation does not start. We again come into the same position of darkness. From darkness, we come to the position of activity. From activity to reconciliation, to harmony. This is the process that goes on. This is the activity of consciousness. And this activity of consciousness is very greatly emphasized so far as Hindu psychology is concerned. You will find the mention about these three attributes at most places. You will find in the writings of Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya, who was one of the ablest of the philosophers that Hindu society has produced, you will find in the writings of Shankaracharya this idea of tamas, rajas and sattva, the three attributes. If the consciousness could be freed of all these three attributes, if it could be freed from the tamas, from rajas and even from sattva, one might say, why from sattva? Because when I come to a harmony, to a state harmony, the state of harmony begins to develop itself into a new laziness, new indolence, new darkness. Oh, I have harmonized, I have reconciled. And therefore the so-called reconciliation becomes the second episode so far as darkness, tamas, is concerned. And so we must move away from that. That is what the Hindu psychology says. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna tells Arjuna, rise above these three attributes. Do not be a slave to these, any of these attributes, neither of tamas, nor of rajas, nor of sattva, neither of darkness, nor of activity, nor of reconciliation. Do not be a slave to anything. Let your consciousness not settle down at any particular point, but the consciousness must be all the time dynamic, active, all the time moving, all the time discovering, because life is anew from moment to moment. And the consciousness that is wide awake all the time is able to become aware of the things that are, because life is changing constantly, rapidly. Every instant, this life is moving. As some Sufi teacher has very rightly said, that you cannot cross the same river twice. When you have crossed the river, then it is another river. Because in the river, the fresh waters come at every moment. If that is the case so far as the ordinary physical river is concerned, much more is the case so far as the river of life is concerned. Constantly new waters come. Life is never the same. At not two moments, life is the same. It's constantly moving. But I do not see the constant newness of life. I feel it is all monotonous. It is the same. It is not the same. There is new, but the mind puts this attribute of sameness. And I feel bored. Oh, if only life does not change. We are curious people. When life does not change, we want life to change. When life is constantly changing, we say, why does not the life remain the same? When I'm in the midst of happiness, so-called happiness, I want life to remain the same, but it does not remain the same. Life does not remain the same. That is the difficulty. Life moves away. When we want the life to remain steady, it does not remain steady. When we want life not to move on, it moves on. In other words, in moments of our so-called happiness, we want life to remain at a standstill. In our moments of suffering, we want life to move. But the life does not move in our moments of suffering. Life does not stay still in our moments of happiness. Life all the time seems to be moving. There are fresh and new waters every moment. But we are unable to see because of the conditioning factor of the mind, our consciousness, controlled and supervised by the activities of the mind. This consciousness is unable to see what is. Otherwise, every moment, if our consciousness is pure, if there is pure awareness, then in that pure awareness we will see everything new coming from moment to moment. And in the life of a person where there is everything new from moment to moment, then there is no moment of boredom at all. He will not feel bored as we feel bored today. It is the same thing, it is the same thing, it is the same thing. Oh, it is the same type of lectures that will be given, and therefore we are bored. Boredom is one of the symptoms of illness today. We feel bored because my consciousness is not able to see what is. There is no pure awareness. If there could be pure awareness, not interrupted by the mind, then we will find that the fresh waters of life are before us. Fresh, lively waters. We shall be able to enjoy it. We may have a dip in the waters, the fresh waters of life, when this happens. But this can happen only when the awareness is pure awareness, not awareness which is contaminated by the past. And therefore, these are the three attributes about which Hinduism speaks. We shall go into this question further, because this is very, very important. The removal of the three attributes and rendering the consciousness pure and unsullied, that is really the basis of spiritual life. How to do it? Is it possible for you and for me, the ordinary people, or must we run away from life and seek our salvation probably in some remote places, in a forest, in a cave? We must sit at the feet of a teacher. We are unable to find a teacher. Is that the way? Or you and I, wherever we are, whatever may be the condition in which we are, is it possible for us to realize that which we want to realize, to discover ourselves, because we have been separated from ourselves? Is it possible? We shall go into this question during the succeeding days, starting this afternoon with the Bhagavad Gita, because the Bhagavad Gita shows the way. It shows the way in a distinct manner. Bhagavad Gita says, don't run away from the field of action. In the very field of action lies your salvation, lies your glory. But we shall come to this Bhagavad Gita, its scintillating message, its stimulating message, its inspiring message, which tells us wherever we are, it is possible for us, because we ourselves have put these obstacles. We can remove those obstacles. And when the obstacles are removed, we are able to come to pure awareness. A person who goes about in life with pure awareness is a person who has come to his realization. He is a realized individual. He is a spiritual individual. And it is towards the creation of that individual that the Hindu psychology takes us through its many teachings. We shall meet this afternoon at night at 7:30 to consider this message of the Bhagavad Gita. But now, after a break, we shall have the second session. Yes, we can proceed. Yes? Yes, to start with, it will be based on false perceptions. But if the dialogue is a sincere dialogue, then probably that dialogue will clear up the falseness with which we are infested. Because there is no other way. You can't retire and find yourself in front of reality. You have to discover reality in the midst of the things that are. Here in the world, active in the world, doing various activities in the world, in the midst of this activity, one must be able to have a glimpse of reality. And reality can come only in glimpses. There is no continuity that I'll now sit and forever I shall be able to see reality. You can't. Reality will come only in glimpses. And the glimpses can come when you begin to realize that something is false. When the false drops away, then the real is there. And therefore, except dialogue, there is no other means by which. Either dialogue with some other person, or dialogue with nature, or dialogue with oneself. Yes, you start with naming. You start with naming because this is our usual process. By naming, to come to the experience of the nameless, that is the right way. In fact, the method that we employ is to go beyond the mind with the help of the mind. Take the help of the mind as far as the mind can help. Because to start with, if you say no, no mind, I will not have the help of the mind, then the mind will go to sleep in tamas. And therefore the mind must be active. In the midst of the activity of the mind, to have the glimpse where the activity has ceased for the time being. As we are going this evening into the question of the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavad Gita's message supremely is this message, not to renounce the world. But in the world, in the midst of the fight, because that is the background of the Bhagavad Gita, in the midst of the battle of life, discover the real. Not by running away. Because the process of running away has been taught by various religions in the traditional fashion. But that is not the way. Where will you run away? You can't run away from yourself. And therefore, wherever you are carrying yourself. And yourself is the false, and therefore you are carrying the false all the time. And therefore, by running away, you can't find. You can't run away from the false. But to see the false as false, if you can see the false as false, then you will be able to come to the perception of that which is real. Yes? It may or may not be, because, yes, but better or not better, that is once again the standard which the mind imposes. You are going nearer to reality. And sometimes going nearer to reality may be through the forest of the unreal. And therefore one has to pass, even though your synthesis may be there, the synthesis may be, for the time being, something false. You get out of it.
Thank you.
process of naming is to give a concept. This is a tree, this is a banyan tree. But why must you call it a banyan tree? Just see, look at the tree. Why must you name it? Yes, but we don't live it. Yes, yes. But we don't leave it a tree. We want to name it. I want to name the flower. Because I want to relate what I see in the context of what I had seen earlier. And therefore I want to put it in the framework of memory. That this is not something entirely different. It is a part of what I have seen. And to be in the midst of that continuity gives us a sense of security. And therefore, out of the sense of security, I name, whatever that name may be. But if I look at something without naming, then that something is perceived as if for the first time. We talk of love at first time. And love at first time is the only love. Love at second time is a bargain. And so if we can be in the world like love at first sight, seeing for the first time as if you have not seen it before, but what we had seen earlier, it comes, imperceptibly it comes. And because it comes, I say, yes, it's a name, because name gives me a sense of security. Yes, without the intervention of the mind, because mind always compares and contrasts. And by comparing and contrasts, it comes to a sense of security. I compare it, oh, it is like this, or it is not like this. But I must have something like something what I have seen, or not like something what I have seen. And therefore this process of comparison and contrast is the process in which the mind is all the time involved. And that is how I name it. My naming process is based on comparison and contrast. That is what the mind all the time does. That is the activity of the mind. If the activity of the mind of comparing and contrasting could stand still for the time being, then I will see what is. But otherwise, what I see is what was earlier like that, or what was not like that. In other words, I don't see what is, but I see only the picture of memory. Memory says it was like this, memory says it was not like this. And therefore, in all our act of perception, memory seems to be coming all the time. If I can see without memory, then there is no naming at all. But the whole naming process is the contrivance of memory itself. If I can keep memory for the time being away, and I see as if for the first time, then I will discover something which I had not discovered earlier. And life is like that. One cannot say, I know life. You cannot know life. Life has to be discovered from moment to moment. But when I say, I know life, that means, yes, I know, I've seen it. It is like this. Or it is not like that. It is little different from that. And therefore, it is by memory, the intervention of memory, that the naming process is done. Bad memory is a help. I'm not talking of amnesia. I'm not talking of amnesia. Because at that rate, no memory is good. But we are not talking of no memory. That means it's not a failure of memory. Memory is there, very active memory is there, but I will not allow that memory to intervene. The mind cannot be put out. The mind is there, but I will not allow the mind to intervene. And that is why the mind must be very, very active. The memory must be very, very active. I must have a clear remembrance of what happened, but I will not allow that memory to intrude where I do not want it to intrude. About? Yes, memory, even otherwise, memory we know is of different nature. There is the retentive memory, there is the associative memory, there is the memory which is a psychological memory. All these are the grades of memory. In fact, much has been written on the subject of memory than probably ever it was written. And therefore, classifications of memory are there. I must have retentive memory. I must be able to move in life intelligently. And in order to move in life intelligently, I need the help of memory. That is all. But I will not allow memory to color my perceptions. To be full of memory possession and yet to understand the restriction, the limitation, so far as that memory is concerned. As I said, we all of us move about with psychological memory. Our retentive memory or our objective memory is very, very limited. Or in all our life, it is the psychological memory by which we go. And psychological memory is due to the unfulfilled experiences of the past. The past experience, because it has remained unfulfilled, it sticks onto memory. And that memory says, oh, you have not fulfilled this, you will not fulfill this. And therefore, I am unable to look at what is. In the process of my looking what it is, I am pulled by something which I have not fulfilled at all, which has remained unfulfilled. And therefore, it is the unfulfilled experiences of the past which is the main problem of meditation. Because in meditation, we say we are distracted. But what is it that distracts you? That which distracts you is the psychological memory. While we must have retentive memory, we must have objective memory, we must see to it that the memory does not become a psychological memory. That means, if I can complete every experience, if there is no residue left of the experience, then there is no psychological memory whatsoever. If the event, Yes? How can we do what? Yeah. If you are able to come to the completion of the thought process, then in the completion of thought process, the memory is finished. Because it is the incomplete thought process which gives a continuation to the memory. If every time my thought process is complete, then there is nothing left. I can go back, then that particular thing will remain there as objective memory, as historical memory, as a retentive memory. But whereas we find that our memory is an associative memory, I see this chair, and I don't see the chair. The chair brings about the association. Oh, on this chair so-and-so sat. And therefore, it is so-and-so that becomes important, not the chair. And therefore, if there could be memory without this association, I can bring into existence the association, but it is not association that is not under my control. The association comes. Why does it come? Because of the unfulfilled experience of the past. If I can complete that experience in the way in which I say, I complete my thought process. Nothing is left so far as my thought process is concerned. The completion of thought process is the completion of experience. And therefore, while I have clear memory, clear objective memory, I am not subject to psychological memory. Yes? Yes, of course. The naming process creates an indirect perception. Then you see that thing through the name. But when there is direct perception, there is no factor of naming. You may name it, then the naming is just a word. But then that naming has no psychological associations. We indulge in naming because we have no direct perception, we have no direct relationship at all. When there is direct relationship, then there is no need for naming. We name our relationship in the absence. The lover discovers the name of the beloved, not when the beloved is present, but when the beloved is not present. Then we require the name. But in the actual experience, naming is not necessary where direct perception is there. Yes? Yes. Yes, naming is necessary for communication. But naming is an obstacle to realization. Naming is necessary, otherwise I can't live at all. So long as I keep naming at the level of communication, there is no difficulty. But when naming becomes an instrument of realization, I've called it a rose and so it must be beautiful. I must experience the beauty of the rose because rose is associated with this. Then I don't see the rose. Then I see the projection of memory. But so many experiences don't all come at a time. At a time is the one experience that comes. And so if I know how to deal with that one experience that has come, then I'll deal with the second, then the third. You don't have to deal with all the experiences at once. Then we will be overwhelmed. But seeing these experiences come one by one, you can deal with one by one. You can complete that experience so that it ceases to be incomplete. To complete the past experience is to see what comes from the past. In fact, we are not going into the question of meditation because we have no time, but meditation is the observation of what comes. And what comes is what has remained incomplete in the past. It is that which comes. If I can observe what comes without any reaction, without accepting or without rejecting, then I have dealt with it. It's gone. It is not going to trouble me. And therefore, I don't have to tackle all the problems all at once because they don't come. They come only one by one. When they come one by one, I can deal with them as they come. And the way of dealing is not to react. If I can observe without any reaction whatsoever, and it is done with it, it's completed, then it is not going to bother me again. But we don't look at anything. The moment something comes, the past experience projects itself. And I want to name it, I want to name it. Oh, this is bad, this is not good, this is not right. I don't look at it without any judgment. The moment it comes, immediately the judgment comes. And that judgment is the naming process. And therefore I do not look at an experience that comes from the past free from the naming process. Of course, there are hundreds and thousands of experiences which have remained incomplete, but I am not called upon to deal with them all at once. If somebody says deal with them all at once, then it's impossible. But since it will come one by one, Because how does the past come? Past comes by a process of association. I see something and the past is revived. And therefore, it does not come all at once. It comes gradually. And as it gradually comes, I can deal with that. That is indeed the problem of karma. The problem of karma about which the Hindu psychology and Hindu philosophy speaks. You are not asked to deal with all your past karmas all at once. But whatever comes at this moment from the past, which is known as prarabdha in the language of the karma, if you know how to deal with it, finished, then you can proceed further. As it comes, you will be able to deal with it, so that there is no accumulation. If the accumulation comes, then you are overwhelmed. You say, how am I to deal with it? I have generated so many karmas, I have generated so many things, if it comes. But it is not gracefully, it doesn't come all at once. It comes bit by bit. It comes one by one. And if my mind is alert, if I am alert, then it is possible for me to deal with that experience as it comes one by one. And therefore one can be free from the past as the past begins to appear in the present. I can act only in the present. And the past comes in the present, not all at once, but one by one. And therefore, there is no difficulty so far as dealing with that which comes from the past, one after the other. The completion of experience is not done by indulging in experience. Because even if you indulge, it remains incomplete. Because very often we say, oh, where is the time to complete the experience? In fact, you don't require time to complete the experience. It is the absence of time that is necessary. Time is created by the mind. And therefore, if you can complete the thought here, and complete the thought means where no residue of thought remains, the thought is completed. It is the completion of thought which is the completion of experience. If your thought has remained incomplete, then that experience is incomplete. But for the time being, if you say, yes, there is nothing further to think about, then that experience ends. Completion of? Yes. Then you are free, you can tackle something else that comes. Yes, understanding is not just mere intellectual understanding. Understanding is the completion of thought. I no longer have to think about it because I have thought. Perhaps later on I may have some more thoughts. But for the time being, my thought is complete, I am free. Later on when such a thing comes and I have some further thinking, I'll do that thinking. But thinking at a time, because all things don't come at a time. And so it is possible for us to complete our thinking as the thing comes. And therefore that which has remained incomplete in the past, when it comes in the present, when it projects in the present, I can deal with it. And therefore I can complete the incomplete experiences of the past. Yes? But was that suffering in the past or is it in the present? But who is suffering? Who is the sufferer? If you go into this question, you will find that it is the mind that is the sufferer. That is why Buddhism says suffering there is, but there is no sufferer. Because it is the mind that suffers. When I have pain in the body, and I am given anesthesia, then for the time being the pain is gone. That doesn't mean that the body is all right. But the pain comes when the brain conveys the message to the mind. If the conveying of the message by the brain to the mind ceases for the time being, then I am free from pain. Because the giver of pain is the mind. And therefore, if I know how to deal with the mind, if the mind can become silent, it is not necessary that I should have anesthesia all the time. But if the mind is silent, and if the mind is silent, then at that moment I am free. I am free from that suffering. It is because the mind broods over. It is the brooding over the mind, the dwelling by the mind. It is that which creates and continues this experience of suffering. That is why the Hindu scriptures say that mind is the cause of bondage, mind is the cause of man's freedom. All our bondage is because of the mind. There is a story of a camel. A camel driver took his camels across the desert, and the night fell, and he said, "Now I must rest." There were a few shrubs, and so he had about 15 or 16 camels. He had 16 camels, but he had only 15 strings. And so he tied each camel to those 15 bushes, the 15 shrubs that were there, tied it. And so the camel was steady. But one camel was not tied because there was no string. But he made an appearance. "Oh, I'm tying you, I'm tying you." Next morning, all the other camels, when their strings were loosened, they got up. But this camel who was not tied did not get up. He said, "I'm still tied, I'm still tied." And therefore, once again, when the camel driver made that gesture that "I'm releasing you," then only he got up. We are also like that. We are not tied, but we think that we are tied. It is the mind that gives the impression that you are tied. And therefore, there is no knot whatsoever. The knot is that the mind thinks that I'm bound, I'm tied here. When the mind releases this, then I'm free. And therefore, the mind is the cause. The camel was not really tied, but camel thought it was tied. And when the gesture was made, he said, "Yes, I'm now free." There was no question of anybody freeing him, not anybody tying him. It was all the process of the mind. And therefore, it is the mind that gives the experience of suffering. Because the mind immediately compares and contrasts. "Oh, I wish this had not happened. I wish something else had happened." And therefore, by the process of comparison and contrast, the mind goes on suffering. Not that there is something that is not happening. Something is happening. Something that is happening which is not in order. But that which is not in order creates a feeling of suffering, because the mind says, "Oh, it could be different. It is not different. It should have been different. It is not different." It is this process in which mind engages itself which creates this experience of suffering. So shall we? We don't meet in the afternoon, so please don't come in the afternoon.